Introduction to Exodus. The first talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on October 11, 2015 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 1, Introduction to Exodus, accompanies this talk.
I'm going to start teaching through the book of Exodus. I worked through Exodus several years ago. I don't know how long it was, probably 15 years ago now. But I just did the narrative portion. I didn't do the law. And this time, I want to get a running start at the law and actually include that in what I teach. And Ron mentioned last week that he doesn't like to repeat himself. I can't remember what I said 15 years ago, so I have no idea whether I'm repeating myself or not. But I have learned quite a bit, I think, since the last time I went through Exodus, and I'm eager to work through it. I was scheduled to start to do a session a month or so ago, and I got sick, and an outline was sent out, but I had lots of time to think about it since then, so it is significantly different now. So it's the newer outline that I will be following. If you have the older one, it will be of minimal value. If you didn't pull it off the internet and you want it, you might have an electronic personal device that you could pull it up on right now. But if you didn't get it, it doesn't matter. I will go through it. I am not going to actually start into Exodus this week. I have some introductory material that I would like to go through, and that is what expanded over the month that I was thinking about it. I kept thinking of things that I should include, and my outline kept getting longer. So this is my lengthened outline. What I would like to accomplish today in my introductory material is, first of all, I want to characterize Exodus. What kind of a thing is it? Then I want to set Exodus in its historical context as best I can, and that will be difficult, but as I will explain. And then I want to talk a little bit about the events that set the stage for Exodus, that Exodus is predicated upon, so you need to know what those are. And then I want to talk about why I think a study of Exodus is worth our time. So first of all, what kind of a book is Exodus? It is primarily historical narrative. We'll get into the law, and that's a little bit different, and we'll have to talk about that. It is set in the form of a historical narrative, a biblical historical narrative. But the biblical historical narratives are not just history. It's not just recounting the events of the past. They are, I am convinced, carefully crafted literary works that a lot of effort has gone into putting them together in a way that is very artistic, that is using literary devices to help us to understand the flow of thought through the historical narrative. And I am convinced at this point that in many cases, in historical narratives of the Bible, if you were to take a word out and replace it with a synonym, you will have changed the text significantly. It is that carefully crafted that each word serves a particular function. A book that has been very helpful to me in gaining some understanding of how the historical narratives work is a book by Robert Alter. He was a professor, I think, at UC Berkeley. It was written, I think, in the 70s. It's called The Art of Biblical Narrative. He has since written one on the wisdom literature and one other genre as well. But his one on biblical narrative is very helpful, and it kind of opened my eyes to how the biblical narratives work. In historical narrative, it is very minimal with respect to descriptions, both of what is going on and especially of what people are thinking. You just don't have that kind of reference. I can't categorically say that because there are a few exceptions, but typically that kind of information is not included in the narrative. What is expected is that the reader will be very active, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, but the reader is expected to be very active, and the reader is supposed to draw on two forms of information that become critical in understanding what is happening in the narrative account. The first is, you know a lot because you're a human being, and you know a lot about how human beings work. So if you're told what the situation is, you can imagine how people are thinking, how they're responding, and why they're responding the way that they are, because they are human beings too. The other form of information that it is depending on the reader having is cultural, historical background. And unfortunately for us, that's a bigger problem. We don't have a lot of that information. We are fortunate in that we have far more of that than they had 100 years ago. That with the discoveries that have been made archaeologically, that has opened up worlds to us that were otherwise closed. So we have a lot more than we used to have, but there's a lot that we do not have, and that creates problems for us as we try to understand the historical narratives. But the writer is expecting the reader to take those two sources of information and use it to make sense of the text. And as a result, the author just says what he absolutely has to say to help you to understand what's going on. Something that I have not fully appreciated until the last few years is the extent to which there are literary devices that are built into the historical narrative that are steering the reader in ways that I did not previously appreciate, and in ways that I'm still learning how to be steered. So, to a certain extent, as we go through, I'm going to point out some of those, hoping to help everyone to become more cognizant of what's going on in the text. Okay, the historical setting of Exodus is essentially ancient Egypt. That the first part of Exodus takes place in Egypt. The Israelites who are coming out of Egypt have been there for over 400 years, so they have absorbed a lot of cultural knowledge and practices. So they are steeped in Egyptian culture. And the entire book, therefore, betrays this Egyptian background. Now, that's not to say that there isn't any Canaanite background to it. There is. But by and large, the setting is Egyptian rather than Canaanite. So I'm going to give a very brief overview of ancient Egyptian history. And then we're going to talk about where does Exodus fit into that. That's going to be the tricky part. Until the development of archaeology in modern times, we knew very little about Egyptian history. All of that had been lost to us. But it has been thanks to the efforts of archaeologists, starting in the time of Napoleon, so starting in the late 1700s, things were found, and we have rediscovered how to read the Egyptian writing. And so that has opened up knowledge to us that was lost for millennia. So the picture is slowly emerging as to what was the history of Egypt. There's a lot that we have yet to learn, but an enormous amount has been learned. We went from zero to what we've pieced together now, which is fantastic. So I am going to present to you just in 10 minutes a millennium of Egyptian history. Egypt was one of the two earliest civilizations. Civilization developed first in Mesopotamia, it is thought, but there are some who would argue that it first begins in Egypt. What we mean by civilization is a city-based culture. Prior to civilization, people inhabiting the earth were largely hunters and gatherers, nomadic or semi-nomadic. But civilization starts when people band together, build a city, and develop a political and social organization. And civilization begins in Mesopotamia, in Sumer, and it's thought to be about 3500 BC. Egypt is the second one. And it's not real clear when it emerges as a civilization. Some people would say 2800. That's what I have written down here. Some would say it's earlier, 3100. But it was a rival civilization to that which developed in Mesopotamia. And I'll point out that it has become more clear in recent years from archaeological finds that there was considerable interaction between the two civilizations from a very early date, that they were influencing one another quite early, much earlier than been thought in 50 years ago. Egypt was a blessed region. That is to say, it had some advantages that no other area of the ancient Near East had. And that's what made it possible for Egypt to emerge as a world power so early and stay a world power for so long. The first of those advantages was lots of water. Even though Egypt is primarily desert, it has lots of water because the Nile River flows right down through the middle. And they were able to take that water and use that for drinking and irrigation, a valuable commodity in a desert. So they have lots of water. The second is they have a long growing season. It is so long that in Egypt they were able to have to harvest 2 and sometimes 3 crops per year. Imagine what an advantage that is over the other areas where you could only get 1 crop a year. That means that you can produce an enormous amount of food in a relatively small area. The third is they have gentle annual flooding. I say gentle, I emphasize gentle, because in Mesopotamia they had annual flooding. But we know from the sources that the floods tended to be big and violent, and they would often overflow the banks. They, on a number of occasions, wiped out the cities that lined the Tigris and the Euphrates. So Egypt has the advantage of having that flooding, but it tends to be gentle flooding, and it tended to be quite predictable. In fact, the priests of Egypt could tell the people on what day the flooding was likely to start. This flooding is important because this water coming from deep in Africa is carrying with it a lot of soil, a lot of silt. And it would deposit, when it flooded, it would have a lot of that silt, and it would deposit that on the sides of the Nile, bringing in fresh nutrients and soil for their farming. So they could farm the same plots of land year after year after year, century after century, and that land not be depleted of its nutrients. That's an enormous advantage. The fourth advantage that they had is easy transportation. Egypt is situated such that the way you got around in Egypt was by boat, and you go on the Nile. And if you want to go north, you stick your boat in the Nile and you sit there, and it's going to take you. The current's flowing north up to the Mediterranean Sea. If you want to go south, you put your sail up, because the winds typically blow from the north to the south. That's incredible. That means you can go north and south whenever you want to go, as far as up to the waterfalls, up to the rapids on the Niles, which are quite a ways up, but that's further south than Egypt usually extended. So, an enormous advantage. And the fifth blessing that Egypt enjoyed was they had deserts all around them. So we've got the Nile going down through desert. Egypt, what we think of as Egypt, is just a strip of land on both sides of the Nile. That's the only part that's populated. If you go further east or if you go further west, it's just desert. That means that you are protected from invasions. It is difficult for foreign armies to come against you. There aren't many routes by which they can do that. That's unlike Mesopotamia. We could contrast all of these with Mesopotamia, the other civilization, and Mesopotamia did not have these advantages that Egypt had. As a result, Egypt became a breadbasket for that whole region at a very early time and became one of the wealthiest areas in the world and continued to be one of the wealthiest areas in the world all the way into the Roman period. Egyptian history can be divided into three time periods: the Old Kingdom, the Middle Kingdom, and the New Kingdom. And in between the Old and the Middle, there is a period of chaos. In between the Middle and the New, there's another period of chaos. So we have periods of relative stability and power in Egypt, interrupted by periods of chaos. The Old Kingdom was from 2700 to 2200 BC. When Egypt first emerged, there were two kingdoms that developed. One in what's Upper Egypt, and what they mean by Upper Egypt is the elevated part, so that's the part to the south. So one kingdom developed in southern Egypt, and then another kingdom developed in the Delta region. But it was clear early on that one of those was going to have to win and incorporate the other in order to survive. And so that is exactly what happened. The two kingdoms were unified in 3100 BC. And just as a point of curiosity, Upper Egypt had a certain kind of crown for its king. Lower Egypt had another crown for its king. The crown that emerges afterwards is one that combines features of both. So it's a composite crown then that the Egyptian pharaoh began to wear in the Old Kingdom period. The Old Kingdom is the period of Egypt that you all recognize from the movies. That's when they built the Great Pyramids. The Old Kingdom was probably the most stable period of Egyptian history. The government was highly centralized, which is not surprising since it is a very geographically constricted area. And the people were heavily taxed. And as a result, it became a very wealthy country. The state had a lot of money. It siphoned off all of the money that it could from the populace and used that money to build those huge pyramids. The distinctive beliefs of Egypt, and these hold true for most of the period of ancient Egypt, it was polytheistic. They believed in a number of gods, as did virtually the whole region. It believed that king was God. That is also something that was true of the whole region, that all of the areas in Mesopotamia believed that the king was also a god. But in Egypt, they seemed to have taken that further than they did in Mesopotamia, that he was really God, he was really had divine qualities that other people don't have, and was in direct communication with the gods. Thirdly, Egyptian society was absolutely permeated with religion. And here's a quote from Hallo, the ancient Near East. He says, "Religion, so woven into the fabric of the Egyptian state, is difficult to isolate. Significantly, the Egyptian language lacks a word for religion, for the concept is unthinkable in Egyptian terms." In other words, what is religion? All there is life. And life is just infused with religion. You can't separate them out. Egypt became a world power, as I've mentioned, very early on. By 2800, it is a world power. And its cultural influence is found everywhere in the ancient Near East, spread throughout the Mediterranean, but also into the Mesopotamian area as well. This I talked about before, the smooth functioning of the centralized government, that it was a coherent society during the Old Kingdom. People worked together harmoniously for the most part and produced a lot of wealth. But towards the end of this period, all of that broke down, the social order broke down, and we have indication there was a lot of unrest, a lot of rebellion of the poor against the wealthy, and we have evidence that the poor rose up in rebellion and confiscated lands that had been owned by the wealthy. And we have a little over a century, it's about a century to a century and a half of chaos, during which period of time there are local rulers who establish these little states within what had been Egypt during the Old Kingdom, and they fight among themselves. So for about 100 to 150 years, there's a lot of chaos within Egypt. Out of that then emerges the Middle Kingdom in about 2040, when leadership emerges that is able to unite Egypt once again into a coherent whole. Once that happened, Egypt became a world power once again. And this time, rather than remaining isolated, Egypt became more aggressive in its foreign policy. It moved to the south into Africa and conquered Nubia, the lands to the south. And it also became very active in Canaan because it knew that if it were going to be invaded, that invasion would come from the north, from the northeast, down through Canaan. And so they saw Canaan as that buffer area that they needed to keep an eye on and have a lot of friends there in order to be protected. During this period of time, the state once again became quite wealthy and once again began these big projects, building projects that had characterized the Old Kingdom. Now, these projects are not as big. They didn't try to build those huge pyramids. They built smaller pyramids, but they also built these tombs, quite elaborate tombs carved in the rocks, but not quite as grandiose as the Old Kingdom had produced. But once again, in about 1790, we see signs that unrest is developing, and for similar reasons, it is disparity of wealth and the poor people rising up in rebellious activity. So we have another period in which there is chaos in Egypt. Then there's an event that happens that is somewhat mysterious. It's mysterious in that there is very little information about this in the Egyptian records. In fact, for a long time, scholars didn't think that there was this invasion by the Hyksos. But more evidence has been uncovered, and now it's quite clear that the Hyksos did indeed invade Egypt. They came down from the north. It's not clear exactly who they were. They came from Canaan. It's possible that they originated further to the north, came into Canaan, and then invaded Egypt. But it's not clear exactly. But we do know that prior to their invasion of Egypt, they did occupy a portion of Canaan. They were particularly well known for their chariots and their ability to fight using the chariots, which were the tank of that era. The Hyksos then came down from Canaan, invaded Egypt, and they took over Lower Egypt. They didn't conquer all of Egypt, but they conquered the biggest and most wealthy section of Egypt and occupied it for about 100 years. And they set up their capital in the Eastern Delta region. And we have archaeological evidence of their occupation of that area. But in about 1550, we know that they were driven out. They were driven out by one of the pharaohs. And we don't know where they went. They just disappear. When they're driven out of Egypt, presumably they went back up north, but they have not been found archaeologically after they leave Egypt. They just disappear. Once they're driven out, we have the beginning of the New Kingdom. In 1550 then, going until about 1070 BC, is the New Kingdom. It is the least stable of the three periods that I've talked about. The Old Kingdom was the most stable. Middle Kingdom was not quite as stable, but it was relatively stable. The New Kingdom, then, there's quite a bit of unrest, even though an Egyptian power is reasserted over all of Egypt. Once again, they undertook expeditions to the south into Nubia. They also took expeditions into Canaan to try to secure that border and reestablish that buffer. It's during the New Kingdom that we have a pharaoh by the name of Akhenaten, and you may have heard of him. He introduced monotheism into Egypt. He established himself as Pharaoh, proclaimed that there was one God, the God that he worshipped, the God that he was a son of, and he rules for a couple decades. And then once he dies, then they revert back to polytheism. But we do have this odd little period of time in Egyptian history where they were monotheists. And there's a lot of speculation about where that idea came from. By 1200 BC, then, Egypt had ceased to be a world power. They've deteriorated as far as their ability to exert their power in the rest of the world. And they, for the most part, kind of hunker down and just protect their lands locally and don't send out expeditions. There are other powers in the world that have emerged that are greater than what Egypt can assemble. Okay, so that's the quick tour of ancient Egyptian history. Now the question is, where does Exodus fit into this? The majority scholarly opinion with respect to the Exodus is that it didn't happen. That's what the majority of scholars who study this sort of thing, that's the position that they would take. There was no Exodus at all. And they point to the fact that there is no solid archaeological evidence that points to or substantiates the story that we have in the Old Testament. In addition, Robert Alter says that Exodus, especially this first part of Exodus, it has a folktale quality. That is, if you're reading it, it reads more like a folktale than it does read as history. And I'll just point out that there are some who make this claim with respect to the first 10 chapters of Genesis as well, that when you read it, it strikes you as having a very folktale quality to it rather than being genuinely historical. The scholars who tend to hold this perspective tend to be those who are minimalists, and I've talked about minimalists in the past. There is, within archaeology as well as biblical history, there is this debate going on, and it's been going on for several decades, between those who see the Old Testament as being reasonably reliable as a historical document, and those who see it as virtually worthless as a historical document. Those who see it as virtually worthless as a historical document are called minimalists. They grant minimal credence to the Old Testament accounts. Maximalists tend to accept it as reliable historical accounts, and if the Bible says X happened, they assume that X happened until shown otherwise, proven otherwise. From my perspective, the question of whether the Exodus did indeed happen or not is a significant question. In studying through Isaiah, it became clear to me that Isaiah believed that the Exodus happened. And he uses the Exodus as proof that God exists and that God is in control of history. So if it didn't happen, if it's just a story that it was made up subsequently, it does not serve the purposes that Isaiah has it serve. From my perspective, if I'm looking at the Old Testament, the Exodus is a huge event. That is the event that all of the Old Testament writers point back to and say, see, God is sovereign. God does act in history. God is in control of things. We know it because of those events, those things that happened at the time of the Exodus. And if you have questions about it, look back at the Exodus. So the Old Testament writers are assuming that a good understanding of what happened at the Exodus would be recorded and passed down from one generation to another and remembered. That's why the celebration of the Passover is so important. It's remembering the events of the Exodus. Because God indicates a number of times, if you're having trouble believing that I'm in control of things, that I am the God that I say that I am, look back at the Exodus. That's when God was uniquely involved in human history, uniquely present and visible in human affairs. In many ways, it's comparable to the New Testament event of the resurrection. But that's what the New Testament authors write about and say, if you want to know whether Jesus was the Messiah or not, look back at the resurrection. That's how we know. I take comfort in the fact that the doubts of the minimalists have been overthrown in my lifetime on a couple of occasions. One is the King's List. Well, this is just before I was born, but almost in my lifetime. The King's List in the Old Testament were, for a long time, it was believed that they are so confused and so wrong. Because if you look what it says in Kings and you compare that with what it says in Chronicles, there are all kinds of things that just don't fit together. It doesn't work. And that proves that the Bible is hopelessly flawed. However, work was done. Edwin Thiel is the one who pioneered this. By looking at how King's Lists were kept in other parts of the world at the time, and looking at and seeing how the authors of the Old Testament would sometimes use the Egyptian style of keeping the King's Lists, and sometimes use the Mesopotamian style of keeping the King's Lists, he was able to account for all of the apparent discrepancies. And that to the satisfaction of virtually all scholars at this point. So that is universally accepted as a solution of the problem of how to put together the King's List in the Old Testament. More recently, and this is definitely in my lifetime, it was believed by the minimalists that David, King David and King Solomon, didn't really exist. And I can remember reading articles about that when I was in scribe school and then after scribe school in the 70s and the 80s, that there really wasn't, David didn't really exist, Solomon didn't really exist, we have no evidence that they existed. It sounds implausible. Israel was much smaller than the Bible claimed that it was at the time and couldn't have had kings of the stature of David and Solomon. But, especially in the last couple decades, there have been a number of things that have been discovered archaeologically that clearly point to the existence of a King David in Israel. To my knowledge, less that points to Solomon, but several that clearly point to King David. So, my perspective on these things with respect to what the minimalists argue didn't happen is I'm content to allow time to pass and see what is dug up. But for a variety of reasons, I am quite confident that the biblical record will be vindicated. So, if the biblical record is true, then where does Exodus fit into the history of Egypt? There are two camps with respect to this. One camp would accept an early date for the Exodus. The other camp would say, no, it happened 200 years after that. So I'll talk about those, the early date and the late date. The early date would say that the Exodus happened in the 15th century BC. So that'd be in the 1400s BC, probably in the middle of that. And the main proponents of that perspective would be David Roll and Bryant Wood and Bimson. I think it's David Bimson could also be added to that list. Those are all either Egyptologists or archaeologists. They hold to that view because they say that view takes the biblical numbers at face value. And I'll take you through how they get to that number then. We know with some certainty that the Temple of Solomon was built in 966 BC. I say with some certainty because when I was in scribe school, which would have been in the late 70s, I was told by one of our teachers that the date of the construction of the temple had been determined and we could be assured that that date was solid. And I was so pleased with that, I wrote it in my Bible in ink. And the date we were given was 970. Well, it has been adjusted since then. So I say 966, but give or take a few years, I suspect. So the temple was built in 966 BC. If you look at 1 Kings 6:1, I will read it. This becomes critical in our chronology. 1 Kings 6:1. Now it came about in the 480th year after the sons of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord, which is the temple. So, 480 years between when the temple was built, well, I should go the other way, between the Exodus and the year that the temple is built. 480 years. So, if we take 966 and add to that 480 years, that puts the Exodus in 1446 BC. Now, we know from Exodus 12:41 and Acts 7:6 that the Israelites were in Egypt for 430 years. So if we add 430 years to 1446, we get 1876 for the date when Jacob and his sons went to Egypt. Okay? So I have here the summary of those two dates. When Jacob and his sons go to Egypt originally, then when the Exodus occurs, 1446. Now, it's pointed out that this creates a very nice chronological symmetry, because if these dates are correct, then the construction of the first temple falls almost exactly halfway between the Exodus and the construction of the second temple. Now, how weighty that is a consideration is debatable, but it is a nice symmetry. Okay, the critics of this perspective raise a number of issues with respect to this position and claim that it just does not work. The first one is that it does not fit all of the biblical data. Hoffmeyer, and I'll talk about him in just a little bit, he's one who is a proponent of the late date. He argues that you can't claim the high ground by saying that your perspective is the one that fits with the biblical data, because there are at least three biblical chronologies that you have to choose from. The first one is the one found in 1 Kings 1:6, and that's the one I went through. But there's another one. If you take the lists of the judges and you total up the years when they judged, it comes to 633 years from the Exodus to the temple. So that's a whole different chronological scheme that is derived from the Bible itself, is what Hoffmeyer would say. Then there's another one. If we take the Septuagint numbers, they are different, the Septuagint being translation of the Old Testament into Greek that was done in about the 3rd century BC. And the numbers in that are different from what we have in what's considered to be our best copies of the Hebrew Bible. That's the Masoretic text. I have it MT here. If you take the Septuagint numbers, you come up with a different biblical chronology. So what he's arguing is, there are several different biblical chronologies, so don't claim that you are using the biblical chronology to come up with your numbers. The second big problem that he would produce is that it does not fit well with the archaeological data. There are two cities that are mentioned in Exodus chapter 1, verse 11, that the Israelites were building. And those are Ramses and Pitom. Those cities did not exist until the 1200s, and they only existed for about 100 years. So the Exodus has to fit into that century, into the 1200s somewhere. Furthermore, if you look at the archaeological information that's been unearthed in Palestine, If you look at the digs at those cities that were, according to the biblical account in Joshua, that were destroyed by the Israelites when they came into the land, we don't find destruction layers in the 1400s. We find more destruction layers in the 1200s. So what little archaeological evidence we have supports a later date rather than the earlier date. Okay. So there are scholars, and I will point out, these are scholars who are maximalists. The maximalists take an early date position, and there are other maximalists that take a late date position. Proponents of the late date position would be Kenneth Kitchen, James Hoffmeyer, R.K. Harrison, Alan Millard. Those are probably the most prominent proponents of the late date. What they do is they take the number that we saw in 1 Kings 6:1 as not a number 479 plus 1, but rather they take it as a symbol. And that 40 is the number that's used to signify a generation. So if you divide 480 by 40, you get 12. So what that number is telling us is there were 12 generations from the Exodus to the construction of the first temple. But we know from demographic information that a generation was closer to 20 years than 40 years. So the actual time span there is closer to 240 rather than 480. See what's going on, what they're doing? And it's argued that this fits the archaeology much better. Ramses and Pitom were in existence then, and they were only in existence for about 150 years. And we know that they were built by slave labor, and they were built out of bricks that had straw in them, etc., etc. And we know that there was a lot of construction under Ramses II in the East Delta using those kinds of bricks. So, they say, it fits that archaeological data much better. So, the late date would argue that Jacob went to Egypt in about 1640 BC. The Exodus happened, and they'll give various dates for that. And I don't think anyone would actually advance 1210 as being the date because, as you see in my next note, there is a stela that was found, an Egyptian stela that was celebrating the victory of the Egyptians over a number of people groups in Canaan, and it can be reliably dated to 1206. And on that stela, it mentions the Israelites as a people that they defeated in Canaan. So we know that the Israelites were existing as a distinct people group in Canaan by 1206 at the very latest. Okay. And that is acknowledged by all scholars. Okay. So it's difficult to know where to fit Exodus into that, and that has been done. You could match up the dates and see where that would fit. But the Hyksos probably were ruling sometime while the Israelites were in Egypt. Either way you take the dating scheme. The Hyksos are about 1650 to 1550. That's approximate, give or take a year. You know, one thing that's great about ancient history is the ancients always did things on even number years. It was very handy. Okay, we know archaeologically that the Israelites were just a part of a larger historical phenomenon. We know that there were Western Semites, by Western Semites I mean those the people group from Canaan, that settled in the East Delta starting in 1800 BC, and they were there all the way through into Greek and Roman times, a large population of them. In the East Delta. The person who has done the most archaeological work there is Manfred Bietok, and I have here a YouTube video. You can watch him give a lecture on it. I think it's interesting. The only problem is, well, there are two problems. One is he's Austrian and he speaks with an accent that's sometimes a little bit difficult to understand him. And the other is, towards the end of the lecture, he's speaking into a mic on a lectern, and towards the end of the lecture, he gets kind of interested in his topic and wanders away from the lectern every once in a while, and you can't hear a word he's saying when he does that. I wouldn't do that. But if you want to see it, it's here, you can find it. They lived in many cities along the east branch of the Nile and the Delta, and the population there was overwhelmingly Semitic. Most of the Egyptians lived along the main Nile River, not in the eastern branch of the Delta. There were cities in the Delta that were inhabited by Egyptians, but they were not typically in the eastern Delta. And it's the easternmost branch of the Delta where the Western Semites were congregated. Now, there's been a term that was found in ancient literature several decades ago, and there's been a lot of discussion about what this term means, but it's the Habiru. The Habiru show up in these writings, and they have a number of characteristics that are pretty strong and keep showing up. They tend to be foreigners. Oftentimes they are slaves. Sometimes they're mercenaries. They can be other things. They tend to be a people group. They seem to be a people group, not a country, a kind of loose ethnic group, and I liken them to gypsies. And they're called the Habiru. It's not real clear why that name was attached to them, but it is highly likely that Habiru, that term, is related to the word that we have, Hebrew. So you'll see in the Exodus account, when the Israelites are referring to themselves, speaking to an Egyptian, they will call themselves Hebrews. So probably Habiru is the term that they're drawing upon. But there were a lot more Habiru than there were Israelites. So the Israelites would be a subset of the Habiru. And the Habiru seems to be a term that is applied to a larger portion of those who are settled in the eastern Delta region of Western Semites. Why did the Semites move there and live on the fringes of Egypt? Well, there were a lot of benefits to doing so. There was a lot more wealth there than there was in Canaan or in the Sinai. There were cultural advantages, and there was a certain amount of security that they could count on Egypt, to a certain extent, being willing to defend that area from foreign invasion. Okay, so regardless of whether it's early chronology or the late chronology, the Israelites would fit into this larger pattern of Western Semites settling in the East Delta of Egypt. Okay, the main themes of Exodus that emerge, I'm taking these from Naum Sarna, who is a Jewish scholar whose work I really like. He's written a lot on Genesis and Exodus. And he came up with this list of themes from Exodus, and I thought it was a pretty good list. First, God controls nature. Secondly, God controls history. Third, history is purposeful. It's going somewhere. Fourth, God is a redeemer from injustice and oppression. But that's the God that emerges from this story, is that God likes to redeem from injustice and oppression. He likes to be the savior of the downtrodden. Fifth, Exodus is a historical metaphor for spiritual salvation, and that becomes important. The Jewish religious calendar is built about Exodus, and we'll talk about that as we come to the various Jewish festivals and how they fit in here. And history is a source and motive force behind ethical values. That is, history gives reason for the ethics that we have, and that's something that he talks about more, and we'll get into that later. What is the background that the author of Exodus expects the reader to have in mind? Well, two things in particular. One is Genesis, and especially the creation account, and the promises that were made to the patriarchs, and Egyptian culture. We're expected to know both of those well. Okay, where are we picking up the story when we launch into Egypt? And I will go through this quickly. What we see in Genesis is that God created the world and mankind, but man turned out to be rebellious against God and his authority. And so the question that emerges in Genesis is, how can mankind be fixed? What can be done to solve this problem? And what we see in Exodus is there are several things that are tried. Warnings are tried, and judgment is tried, but neither of those is capable of restraining the evil impulses in human beings. And even the reset of the flood was not able to tame the sinfulness in man. So, what God does is he picks a human being and he decides that he is going to work in the life of that human being and bring about changes. Abraham is the individual that he picks, a man at random, for all we know. He blesses him and he takes him through experiences and through that teaches him to be obedient. And he makes a number of promises to Abraham, and those promises become hereditary. They're passed down from Abraham to his children. It says in Genesis 15, 5 through 7, he took him outside and said, "Look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them." Then he said to him, "So shall your offspring be." Abram believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. He also said to him, "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to take possession of it." So there are two parts to this promise that keep getting repeated. You will have countless descendants, and you will have the land of Canaan as your own possession. For the sake of time, I will skip down, but that same promise is repeated to Isaac and to Jacob. But he also says to Abraham that his descendants are going to be slaves in Egypt. So in Genesis 15, 13 through 16, he says, "Then the Lord said to him, 'Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your fathers in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure.'" That was something that was told to Abraham way back in Genesis. The promise with respect to the descendants without number and the land of Canaan being given to their descendants is repeated to Isaac. It's repeated to Jacob. And then I won't recount the story of Joseph. I'm sure you're familiar with it. Joseph was one of the 12 sons of Jacob. He was Jacob's favorite son. The other sons were jealous of Joseph, so they took him captive, sold him into slavery. He was taken to Egypt where he worked as a slave. The brothers told Jacob that Joseph had been killed by an animal. So Jacob thought that Joseph had died at that early age. But in fact, Joseph was in Egypt. He served as a servant, a slave, ended up in prison on false charges, but got the attention of the Pharaoh because he could interpret dreams. And he interpreted Pharaoh's dreams and was given a high position, the number two position in all of Egypt, in control of, he was given the responsibility of collecting all of the food that could be collected for 7 years, stored that because in the dream that was given to him, to the Pharaoh, there were going to be 7 years of abundance and 7 years of famine. And that 7 years of abundance, they were able to store grain that allowed them to survive the 7 years of famine. And Jacob and his sons were put in a position where they had to go to Egypt to get food because they were living in Canaan, where the famine also affected them. And Joseph was reunited with his father and his brothers. And they moved down into the East Delta region. They moved to Goshen, which is the East Delta region. So in Exodus, we are picking up the action 400 years later, 430 years later, after the action in Genesis has come to a close. Okay, why is Exodus worthy of our attention? First of all, it has become increasingly clear to me that the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, are really foundational for understanding the Bible as a whole. We had a summer institute where we were exploring the use of the Old Testament in Matthew, and I took a passage in Matthew that forced me to look back at a passage in Jeremiah, because that's what Matthew was quoting. But the passage in Jeremiah was relying on a passage in Genesis. And that's typically the case. As you're looking at passages, whether it's the New Testament or the Old Testament, they allude to things that send you back further in the Bible. And ultimately, everything is built on the foundation of the first four books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch. So I personally am interested in becoming much more familiar with those first four books. Secondly, as I've mentioned before, the Exodus was a time when God acted overtly in human history. And it's something that is looked back at by Old Testament authors and New Testament authors as an example of God being active in human affairs and being in control of history. So I would like to understand that better. And thirdly, Exodus is the Bible's paradigm of salvation. I'm confident of it. That if you want to understand what the Bible means whenever it uses the word salvation, its paradigm for that is God bringing his people out of Exodus. That is in some way analogous to salvation as it's used elsewhere in the Bible. And I would like to understand that better. It is also the case that I personally am interested in making sense of history as a whole. I think that history is God's novel. It's God's grand novel. And it's there for us to study and to understand. And that the Bible can play a huge role in helping us to understand human history. And the book of Exodus is describing a pivotal portion of that human history. Okay, and what would I like to accomplish as we go through Exodus for the next, and I don't know how long it'll take, it could be a few years. There are some teachers who try to show how all of the Old Testament points to Jesus. I believe that's true, that there is a sense in which the Old Testament is all pointing to Jesus. But it seems to me that there is great benefit in understanding the Old Testament in its own terms. So there may be times when I will point forward to Jesus from Exodus, but I don't intend to do a lot of that. You can do that on your own. I'm trying to understand Exodus as the readers would have understood it at the time that Exodus was written, as best I can. Secondly, I'm not very applicational. I've talked about that before. I just don't think that that's how the Bible works. I've talked about this at length elsewhere, so I'll give only a very short version of this, but I have concluded that you can't apply verses to your life. You can't apply passages to your life. The only thing that you can apply to your life is a worldview. And you build that worldview from passages and verses. That's absolutely true. But it's an understanding of who God is, who we are, why we're here, what we're all about. That's what can be applied. And so I think that Exodus is very relevant in understanding better who we are and who God is. And it is therefore very applicable, but the way you have to get there is to allow it to shape your understanding of the world and how it works and how we fit into it. I think Exodus is particularly relevant for our time, as I've been looking at the first few chapters of Exodus in particular, because it's talking about a period of time in which the people were, God's people, were afflicted by the culture, a foreign culture, and government. And it seems to me it's not difficult to find parallels to our own time. What I am going to do, what my goal is to help you, as best I can, to understand the text of Exodus as it was intended by the author. And I'm hoping to be a guide in that process in the same way that Philip was a guide to the Ethiopian eunuch. I'll read this. You're probably all familiar with it, but I like it a lot. So he started out, this is from Acts 8, 27 through 31. So he started out, and on his way he met an Ethiopian eunuch, an important official in charge of all the treasury of Candace, queen of the Ethiopians. This man had gone to Jerusalem to worship, and on his way home was sitting in his chariot reading the book of Isaiah the prophet. The Spirit told Philip, "Go to that chariot and stay near it." Then Philip ran up to the chariot and heard the man reading Isaiah the prophet. "Do you understand what you are reading?" Philip asked. "How can I," he said, "unless someone explains it to me?" So he invited Philip to come up and sit with him. I would like to play that role as best I can of what Philip did with respect to the Ethiopian eunuch, to help just to peel back the difficulties as best I can and help you see what's in the text. Focusing on what is it saying, how is it saying what it's saying, and what are some of the implications. I talked a little bit about the nature of the biblical narratives. From my perspective, it requires a very active reader. You have to be asking yourself a lot of questions about why is this happening, and why did he say this, and why did he do this, and trying to piece together all of the clues. Some of the questions that get raised can't be answered. The author simply hasn't given you what you need to be able to answer those questions. But some can. And I think that we have to allow the text to steer us, allow the text to determine which questions we should pursue and which questions can't be pursued. But what I have found is that they are very subtle texts, so that you end up hanging quite a bit on a subtle clue. And you'll have to keep me in check as to whether I have done it well or not. I have an enormous amount to learn. I benefit more from teaching than those I teach. I know that's the case. My study of Isaiah was really revolutionary for my understanding about the Bible. It convinced me that I need to be more attentive to the details that I see in the Old Testament text. I need to develop a vocabulary that I have not fully developed, because I need to understand the full Old Testament milieu. That is, what is the culture that God ordained be established in his people, such that they would look out at the world and understand certain symbols and certain words, the significance of these festivals, the significance of these religious actions, and their thought patterns, how they think about the world. And I need to absorb that so that I can then, in turn, look at other parts of the Bible with those same kinds of eyes, and in particular the New Testament. And I've made up a term to refer to that, looking at the Bible tanakhically. Tanakh is the Hebrew term for the Old Testament. What I mean by this term is I want to learn to look at the Bible through the eyes that have been shaped by the Old Testament as given to us by God, and the culture that emerges out of that. So that's my goal. It seems to me that's a very important thing. I had missed how important that was until the last few years. And so it's something that I desperately want to work on and see what kind of progress I can make. I went overtime, I'm sorry, so I won't open it up for questions. But we'll start on Exodus chapter 1, verse 1 next week. Thanks.